What is up, podheads? Back with another episode of the Podio Slave Podcast. My name is Tony. I am joined once again by Anthony and Nate. How are you guys doing tonight?
I'm doing great, man. I got my pager and it started beeping. I'm like, oh, we got a podcast episode to record. I'm fucking down. Let's do it.
The bat signal.
Yeah, baby.
You're not here for every episode, but the ones that we have you on for are very special. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you feel special.
I feel very nerd special. Like, oh, dude, me? I'm down. Fucking go, man. Let me reach into this cobweb bin of Kerrang magazines and see what I can dig up.
Those are fucking heavy. Those bins are fucking heavy, man. I remember carrying one up a couple flights of stairs at camp last couple summers ago. Yes. With you. And we made a great episode out of it. Go back and check that one out. It's in the 120s, I think. But yeah, man, good to have you back. As always, we like to do the three of us nerding out on a topic or an album that we love, and tonight is no different. We've got the Used self-titled, right? Not untitled. It's the Used / the Used, I believe. So yeah, we're gonna dig deep into this seminal record, one that I think we all have very fond feelings for.
Big time. This is one, and if you've heard this pod, I talk about certain albums that have stayed in rotation over the years. This is absolutely one of them. And have we talked about the Used at all on the pod? I was trying to think of that. Have we?
Barely. If we have, it's been in passing. How? You saw them? I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, if we talk about, you know, the fabric of our musical journey together, like, this has got to be a band that is up there in terms of like the connective tissue of our music friendship, I would think.
Absolutely.
Especially this album in this era.
No, agreed. It covers so many different styles of music. And then, you know, that year, 2002, was such a pivotal change in like styles of music. Basically, new metal had ended in 97 to like an 01 run. And 2002 to like call it 05, 06 was a whole new legacy of music that came out, and the Used very much so catapulted that new wave of music. Call it screamo or emo, whatever you want to call it. And we dove right in. We lived it in the moment, and it was fucking rad as hell. And this band is such a huge proponent of that. You know, we talk about like Mount Rushmore's of the scene. The Used, after studying for this episode, I'm like, well, they're fucking one of them all day, and this record especially. So yeah, dude, this is super cool.
I mean, perfect timing for us, as I think it came out right as the summer before our senior year started, right? And I don't know that I was paying attention to it hitting in June of 2002 when The Taste of Ink popped off. That's probably when I started to hear it a little more and see it a little more and get more into it. But I know, Anthony, were you in on it early? I can't remember.
I was in pretty early. So it came out June 25th, 2002. My first exposure, which I had to do some fact checking and make sure it wasn't one of these, I don't know what they call them. There's a term for it, like alternate reality things. It was Box Full of Sharp Objects music video on Fuse or Much Music or MTV2. I think it was MTV2.
I was going to say MTV2 at like midnight, something like that.
Exactly. I remember, I'll never forget. It's one of those like home video live footage music videos. And I remember being drawn in by the name of the song, one, and two, Bert's screams. Of course, I didn't know Bert at the time, but Bert's screaming. It was like, it wasn't a metal yell or scream. It wasn't a hardcore one. It was like a guy's intentionally trying to throw out his voice. He's literally like throwing up into the mic. And like Corey Taylor gave you a little of that with Slipknot, like that type of trying to make the mic explode. But it was those two things where I was like, what is this? Like, it was very different. But yeah, it was definitely 02. It was probably after the album came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember seeing that video, but it was probably at 4 or 5 months after for me. That song, we'll get to it in a little bit. That song is one of my favorite songs, I think, ever. But the video is wild, like Bert puking on stage, and it's like found concert footage. And for them to lead off with that when they had The Taste of Ink and Buried Myself Alive kind of just hanging out in the wings ready to go. Holy shit, man. Like they knew what they had. They had some fucking badass songs, and it was a record that I found probably through hanging out with you, Anthony. I know the summer before our senior year, we spent a lot of time with our buddies Ian and Setla, you know, casually dubbed Tits, Tone, Ian, Twan, and Setla. And we spent a lot of time listening to music in either Ian's room or down at the beach, or because when you're 18, 17, have nowhere to go, no place you can get into, all you do is drive around listening to music. And I'm sure this song probably made its way in around then, and I was like, ooh, what is that? And then I ended up going, once the Taste of Ink hit, I ended up going and buying it at Best Buy and being all in from then on out.
And that's the irony is, I looked, the Taste of Ink was released as a single in September 2002. Buried Myself Alive was in January, and then Blue and Yellow was May, you know, the following year. Box wasn't even a single, but I remember it, they had the music video, and I feel like it hit radio. Am I crazy thinking that?
I don't remember it, but it might have, yeah.
I thought it did too, but I think we're just, like you said, that parallel universe, like it was, right? Because it seems like a perfect song for the radio, but I don't think it ever was, at least in the States.
It's the Mandela effect. That's what I was trying to think of. It's that, yeah, like thing everyone thinks they remember, but maybe they didn't.
Well, if it was on Fuse and MTV2, that felt like radio at that time, and those were still tastemakers for us, especially in 2002. So that's probably why it feels that way. But Mandela effect, yeah, it's a good one.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we might have had that sentiment, Twan, for me, and you know, we've talked about it on here before. My subscription to Kerrang! Magazine was living that parallel universe with, like, they're talking about it in Europe through this, via this magazine. Sometimes it came with a CD with a bunch of singles that they're talking about, so it's almost like an advance sneak preview of what's going on, even though it's like a US band, but they're just so on the cutting edge over there, or they were at the time in UK, that I got like two different versions of like what's going on, in some cases proactively, like we talked about on the Blink episode. So I got a little bit of a sneak peek before the album dropped, but didn't really know what was going on because I only got that one song, which was Box of Sharp Objects, which is such a fucking jam. Like, it's such a, just a fucking killer song. And geeking it out on the context of that song really is like the epitome of nerdery, right? Because it's really about the true love of music itself. But yeah, I think Kerrang! Magazine, MTV2, not necessarily on the radio, but kind of seeking it out in all, you know, alternative platforms, gave us an appreciation for this band on a almost like a, oh, we knew them before they kind of came out level, which is always super special.
So we all have pretty distinct memories of like first hearing it. And I remember, I obviously drawn to the name of the song, but just the ebb and the flow of the vocals. Like, this guy who has the voice of an angel and then goes to this screaming, which obviously we heard scream, like we're veterans of Ozfest and Warped Tour, but this was a little different. And the fact that you saw it on that stage, on the MTV stage, it was just, I don't know, it was ballsy for like MTV, you know, this, you know, interesting quote, you can, out of context is kind of interesting, but like, it was ballsy for MTV to put that out there. Like, what did they, I think I said this with the Glassjaw episode, what did they think the ceiling was? This was going to move 10 million units? No. It was interesting. But you're right. It was a maybe a natural progression from nu metal and pop punk.
Yeah, there was screaming before, but something about this felt different. And for me, listening to it in the moment, I was like, do I like screaming? Like, I hadn't really gotten into a ton of music that did what the Used were doing at this time. And I just remember thinking to myself, sometimes this is something that will keep me from it, that will shy me away from it. This still happens to this day. Sometimes I can't get over the vocal delivery, and it's like, all right, I like a lot of what's going on here, but the vocal delivery is, it's driving me away. In this instance, there was so much around it, and I kind of loved the way that Bert delivered. I was like, nope, I'm all in on this. And it's, and just listening back to it tonight again, I was like, this still hits so well. Like, he is the driver of what they do. They're all great musicians, but he puts them over the top with his delivery, and going from being able to sing to screaming the way he does, right back into singing. There's really not much like it. I mean, plenty have tried and failed miserably because there aren't too many Burt McCrackens out there. And it's obvious over the last 20 years that there's less and less of those than we expected. But he and them as a whole just put something together that was so on point and fit everything that I was looking for in music, that what we weren't getting at that point.
Yeah, I think what you're both saying, and what I'm definitely feeling, especially after revisiting the record in preparation for this, is there's like an honesty in that scream that's not like, okay, now's the verse, here's where you scream. On this record and this band and Bert's vocal delivery, it's like, I want to equate it to like Layne Staley type emotion. Like, oh my God, he really means it. Like, he's not just saying because that's the time in the song to scream. It's like, God, he's just trying to get it out of this fucking system.
Yeah, there's something going on there where he's,
yeah,
he's getting it out.
He's getting it out, exactly. It's not like a role. It's like, no, I have to get this out. And if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right now. And it's like, yeah, it captivates you completely. So I wrote that as a note too, just because the singing to screaming, the way he's even able to hold his voice without losing it and back into singing is, goddamn, that's insane. But very much pronounced on this record.
Especially at that time. Like, he was young, but at the same time, doing a lot of stuff, and it's been chronicled, doing a lot of drugs and drinking and doing stuff that he might have gotten him to a point where we never saw him again, and he was still able to pull this off. I mean, I remember when we saw him, and we'll probably get to the show, but when we met them in Portland at the Bull Moose signing, and he looked like death warmed over. He was just like, dude, how do you do this every night? And that's probably because he was letting it all fucking out, and he was on tour with Thrice and just fucking ripping through 10 songs a night as hard as he fucking could, because that's the way that they were back then.
Well, it's funny, like, this all paints the picture, like, so accurately, but the interesting thing is, there was a camp that thought they were industry plants, because I did some digging, they formed with Bert as the vocalist, I think in January of 2000, I think, did I read that right? It was in 2000.
It was 2000, yep.
2000. This album comes out in June. Think of everything that has to happen in 2.5 years. You get to release an album, mix it. I'm going backwards. Mix it, record it, write it, become a band. You know, all that happened so fast that, like, it almost does. Actually, I'm looking now. I think they formed in 2001.
No, it was 2000. And what you're looking at is incorrect. I remember reading this in the Alt Press 20 years of it. It was 2000 because they said, like, a bunch of different places at 01 because of merch, when merch popped and the merch was wrong. Wrong year on the fucking t-shirts. So that's why people think they started in 01. Yeah, well, there's a little nerdery tidbit for you, but they started in 2000. I read that in a 2000, the 2002 20-year look back in 2022 from Alt Press last year. So. Yeah, you're right. It's 2000.
So 2000. Yeah, I mean, even still, 24 months for all that to happen, to get signed, linked up with Feldman, I had to write the songs first. It's like, it defies conventional anything. But I guess my punchline is like, they clicked. It clicked. Bert, just right place, right time. There's so much honesty and grit in his vocals that, man, I don't know. It was lightning in a bottle. And obviously they've released 9 albums and, you know, huge legacy to this day. But this was, man, all the stars aligned with this one.
Yeah, right place, right time, as you mentioned. But time being very much something we should highlight. There was a lot of money in the industry at the time. So if you had anything going for you, and if lightning was in a bottle, like, I guess there was a fast track to get signed. And The Used was a perfect example of that. Had something like this happen today, I don't know, man, you know? So 2001, jumping into 2002, or call it 2000, and then a 2-year cycle to get, you know, get things going. I think it was just perfect timing, really.
Well, the other thing that I read in that Alt Press kind of retrospective, they had Feldman, they had Kevin Lyman, who's a guest on this podcast back in the day. They had Bert, they had Jeff, and Quinn, I think. Yeah, all of them kind of given a little bit of what happened, and their manager too. And the guys who were in the band before Bert joined, Jeff and Quinn and Brandon, they had been sending stuff to Feldman, and Feldman was like, this is cool, but whatever. And I think Jeff was singing, and he was like, there's something here, but it's not fleshed out. Like, let's not jump on this just yet. And then they added Bert, and Feldman was like, where are these guys? Get them in here now. Like, and Feldman has said it's the biggest record he ever produced, even though he's gone on to produce some really big records. He says, if I didn't do that one, I'm nowhere today with as far as producing goes. So that's pretty wild.
I believe that, because this was up to that point, I think he had just done the Goldfinger stuff, and he had maybe done some A&R for Real Big Fish or something I saw, but this was what put him on the production map.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about this album and the sound is, it like, if you think of time, it predates Thrice major label. It predates Thursday major label. Like, what did their, what do you think their angle was with this? Was this like, hey, fans of Incubus, I have something a little edgier, or hey, pop punk fans, this has a little more bite to it? I was trying, when I was listening to the album today and getting into the context of the time and trying to understand the music biz of all of it, like, I wonder what their angle was, because this predates a lot of everything that came after it.
It's a really good point. And I'm trying to think, because Feldy, you know, he was in Goldfinger, still is. They were doing the Warped Tour circuit. We've all been to Warped Tour. I think I went 2000, 2002, and 04. I think that's all I did. But regardless, there was such a like a hybrid and like hodgepodge of like different styles of music. I wonder if Feldy personally had like a pulse on like, okay, I saw this at Warped Tour in like a very small level, so I know it's coming up. I know it's like, it's there, it's about to pop. And this band's reaching out to me, because they were reaching out to him personally, right? I don't know how that even happened, because Feldy had never even produced a record before this. So there was some insider tip, I'm assuming. Like, hey, he wants to produce, and this music's coming up. And another perfect storm type scenario. But to your point, Tuan, there was nothing like this before. There was like kind of some teases of it. And the whole Incubus, you know, mention and different styles of music, that new metal wave was gone on like the downslope. So what's next? And this is what was next. But how do you know that? How do you know so much to produce a record, get it signed to Reprise, and watch, you know, the tides turn in a full, you know, style of music collectively? It's just like kind of ironic. And we can't help but think like that doesn't just happen.
Well, we've done it on this podcast for almost 4 years. We don't know how some of that stuff happens. And this is one of those ones where I'm kind of at a loss too. Like, yeah, they were sending stuff to Feldman before, and then they were sending stuff once Bert joined that kind of turned the tide a little bit. But at the same time, you've got to get a bunch of different players on board for that to even happen. And the sound is different enough that you're like, where does this go? Like, it does kind of go on Warped Tour. And it, I mean, I guess it could have kind of gone on Ozfest in spots, but I'm not sure it would have worked at Ozfest. Where do you put them? Where do you see them going? Is it radio friendly? I mean, a couple songs were, but most of the record is not radio friendly because of the screaming. And especially at that time, I mean, today may be a little different, but I don't know how the fact that this record exists, the way that it exists, is really crazy.
Well, the crazy thing is how, I don't know if you guys saw this, but there was a release before the major label called Demos from the Basement. I don't know if, yeah, Demos from the Basement, yep, from 2001. It was the demo that they put together. It's 10 songs. Like, seven of them ended up on the full length. Like, they had the tracks. This wasn't like concocted in a lab. Maybe a couple of the songs, maybe, because I think Buried Myself Alive and Blue and Yellow were not on the demo. But maybe, mm-hmm, Memories, Taste of Ink, Say Days Ago, Poetic Tragedy, Box of Sharp Objects, all these they had written. So, like,
right,
you know, people throw around Industry Plant. Well, no, these were written. These guys had the chops. They had the skills. It just, you throw in Feldman, you throw big production budget, mm-hmm, slick production, like all these ingredients, it all makes sense. But a lot of people, I don't think, give the band the credit they deserve.
Oh, and they should. I mean, they put maybe Memories, they like had just demoed it, put it together, and brought it to this bowling alley that they was near where they lived, and played it over the nice sound system they had there, because that's what you did when you lived in Utah and had nowhere to bring it. And people were like, this sounds really good, guys. Like, you should send this off places. And obviously they did, and the rest is history. But they weren't concocted in some lab.
Yeah. No, and to that point, having those songs recorded beforehand just reminds me of like a comedy act. Like, it's been worked out. They've played it in rehearsal. They've played it at small clubs. there's staying power in those songs enough to transfer them to the final edit. Like, yo, like, we know these songs kill because we played a, you know, 200 cap room with four people in there and they're all fucking loving it. Not one of them walked away. So we know we at least have four fans, and then upgrade that and go, you know, go forward. It's been like copy and paste enough to be like, yo, like, we know, like, this is proof of concept. We already know. So we're not going to like write a whole new record once we, you know, get a reprise offer. Like, these are, this is where it's at. And that's why I brought up the whole grunge thing earlier with Alice in Chains. I think that same sense of like, they've been already jamming these songs. They already have a little bit of a following. I don't know what the following was like in Utah at the time for the Used in particular. But I know that that is, given the amount of guests we've had on here, that is like kind of the cadence. Like, you get a local following. They're like your honest friends that tell you, yo, it could be better, or it's really shit, or it's really shitty, or whatever, or it's really, really great. But your best friends will tell you like when it needs work, you know? So, and that's how you really hone it in.
All right, so we've given memories, we've set the stage of the time period. Let's get into the album itself. So we've been listening to this body of work for, when this episode drops, 22 years. We've been soaking in this music. And I was thinking today, guys, 22 years from present to 2002 does not seem like a lot of time. But that same amount of time from 2002 backwards would have put you at 1980. Dude. This album does not feel 22 years old. Like in the early 2000s, when you listened to music from 1980, it would sound stale and dated. You could tell it was of a time period. When I listen to this album now, it feels very modern, and mm-hmm. a lot of it's technology and production and all that, but crazy. 22 years. What hit you? What stood out? What notes, what observations do you guys have? Because I have a ton of them.
Me too. I actually went through it track by track and wrote down a note for each song.
Ooh, nerd alert.
The opening track fucking kills. It's perfect.
Slays.
It is a perfect open to the record. It gets you ready for what you're going to experience over the rest of the record. It gives you a little bit of everything from what they can do. It throws the screaming stuff right at you at the beginning, but it's amazing. Like, it's just got this build with that guitar riff right at the beginning, and you're just like, holy shit, boom, there it is. Like, first listen through, you're like, wow, can I have more of this? Just shoot this directly into my veins.
Dude, fucking Maybe Memories. Amazing opening track. The fact that they left like them kind of tuning their instruments before the drum fills come in at the beginning is like an immediate like, oh, I'm at a live show. This is fucking epic. They're just ready to go. Okay, drummer ready. Okay, rolling. Let's go. Fucking boom. And it just gives that extra layer of like authenticity. Like, oh, dude, they are playing their instruments. They do mean it. This is fucking sick. And it just escalates from there. Amazing opening track. But that really, if that doesn't captivate you, I don't know what will. And that's without Burt's vocals out of the gate. That's just the band kind of like getting you ready for this new animal. So I'd say, even if this band did not have Burt, who's just a huge part of this band, I don't want to say he carries this band, because I think the instrumental, you know, part of this band is so, so massive. Like, you could just, I think we had heard this somewhere else, but like bands that can carry themselves instrumentally, call it like bands like Explosions in the Sky, like, are so solid just that. And then you throw in some like very emotional and deep lyrics and vocal ability to that, and you have like this unparalleled, especially at the time, package.
It does set the stage for the album. And Nate, that feedback, the rumor was back in the day is that that was a vibrator that had, they like put the vibrator up to the guitar strings, and that's what that feedback was. And
really? Wow.
In prepping for this episode, that came up again. So either it's one of these lore stories that's gotten thrown around for 20 years, or it's true. I think it's true, knowing these cast of characters. But you're right, it does set the stage for the album in so many ways. Lyrically, it's about drugs, right? Drug addiction, and how it, you know, Burt managed to recover from it. It sets the stage screaming and singing, you know what I mean? And like the build in the beginning. And the beginning, the dun, 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 that kind of reminds me of Incubus. That's why I brought up Incubus earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's interesting. It's like a good, it's a perfect like transition segue for folks of any, into any alternative music in that era. Like this, if you heard that first minute, whether you're a nu metal kid, whether you're a Warped Tour kid, whether you're a pop punk kid, like there's something in here for everyone. You know, the way he repeats, I'm not going to look back. I'm not going to look back. Like that's very, you know, nu metal, you know what I mean? To repeat something like that, you know, but
very true. And it's funny. We go back to Holiday Kirk coming on this podcast, and I don't know if he, I think he told us in the episode, I don't know if it made the episode or not. I have to go back and listen, but he wants to adopt the Used as nu metal. Like this is a band that he rides for, even though they're technically not in the nu metal genre, even though everything is somewhat in the nu metal genre. He was like, that band's nu metal, man. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. That might, if I find that clip, it might happen right now.
I gotta rescue Papa Roach from emo, and I gotta bring the Used over to nu metal. I gotta be like,
I like this.
I gotta be like, can we adopt your band from the sinking ship that is emo? Because
I mean, who else would do it? It's you, Kirk. It's
the CEO. Well,
you are the guy.
All right, other songs that kind of hit you guys. What else did you have?
So I wrote three down. Maybe memories we already touched on, but Poetic Tragedy would be a very much standout track for me. I'd say it's maybe, I want to say it's my favorite, but maybe Memories really is number one. In terms of like what we have already kind of elaborated on with what this band brings to the table, that song encapsulates that 100%. Just deep, right? Just a deep fucking song lyrically and emotionally.
And that's one that it kind of allows you to take a breath, right?
Yep.
And it's about his like maybe religious upbringing in Utah.
That we often will say, does this album have a miss when we're doing a full deep dive? Mm. I put miss next to this one. So it's funny that, I just think they have slow songs on here that I think fit them better. And this one's good. Don't get me wrong. I love the whole record. This is not a knock on Poetic Tragedy or what Nate feels like. But for me, it was of all the songs on here, this is probably my least favorite.
I'm probably somewhere in the middle. Like, it's not one of my favorites, but it's also not a skip or a miss for me. Listening back, the production was a big standout for me because this, like we said, this set the tone for the Feldman era. And it was the Feldman era between this and Story of the Year. Like, you know how with movies, you can tell a director's style, like a Scorsese film, you can tell.
Yep.
Feldman. You can tell, and it's a not a knock. It's his branding. It's his stamp. And I was gonna say, like, how did he find it that early? But he didn't find it that early. Like this allowed him to find that. I think he used this blueprint, and it's just so distinct. The drums. It's tough to describe unless you've heard his projects. But man, if they had someone else at the helm, it might have been a different story.
It definitely would have been a different story. I think you're right. They found each other in this situation where it's like, I hear what you're sending me. This is amazing. Let's clean this up. And then being like, yeah, we'll be semi-moldable. I know Bert was a little more into that than some of the other members, but they were, and they made it work and put out this, it does sound like him. And it's the first of that really for the most part. And it's such a great front to back record. I think I listened to Bert was on with Krista Makes of Less Than Jake, his podcast, talking The Taste of Ink. And I think Chris does a good job of like breaking down the actual like in studio stuff, which is a little bit nerdy for us, but he's a musician. He knows it. And he was like, is this the first time you guys are using Pro Tools? And it was a very early in the Pro Tools world on Macs where there was cut and paste and a little bit more leniency with that stuff versus reel-to-reel tape stuff that was a little more difficult to clean up. You had to record it again, maybe. In this, you could just clean some stuff up here and there. So I think that was the case. If you haven't listened to that episode, it's a pretty cool episode of Krista Makes a Podcast with Bert about The Taste of Ink, which is, you know, it's a standout track, obviously. It's the song that kind of blew them up. But it's cool to hear how that all kind of came about.
Yeah, a lot of, like, stars aligned for this because you have the band. So this was recorded in what, 2001, 2002. So we're talking 21, 22 years ago. They're early 20s, right? Moldable, young, recently in a band. You got Feldman, young, very young in his producer career. You take those two ingredients out of it, if they were maybe a little older, maybe a little more set in their ways, or Feldman, who had a formula at that point, he didn't. If those two things didn't happen, we see a different album. I don't even know if we see this album.
No, that's a great point. I think it's that exactly. Man, you really nailed it on the head, because it's like a relatability element. Feldy is in Goldfinger. He's playing 300 cap rooms at the time. Like, he's not like this major, you know, Ross Robinson or Rick Rubin of the world. Like, this is his first record, right? But he knows what a good record sounds like, because the Goldfinger records from inception sound amazing. They sound great. So clearly he was taking notes on a producer side of things, which is super cool. Your take on the fact that it's very Feldy in a director type standpoint is also very important to bring up, because immediately when you said that, I just shot to David Fincher. And the way David Fincher directs is, yes, you're paying attention to subject matter one, but if you really pay attention to my canvas, there's so many intricate parts in the background of the scene that are so much part of the storyline. And that's what Feldy does with his producing. The bass is very pronounced. Usually you forget about the bass. It's just normal. Like, it's bass just is out guitar there, yeah. Vocals. Guitars, vocals are usually front and center. Drums, bass are kind of behind the scenes, but definitely supporting that in terms of the whole foundation of the music. For this record, and for, I guess, for Feldy's production style, the way I listen to the record today, and now that you mentioned the whole director element, is I listen to this in the car today, and it's like the guitar is my front right speaker in my car, bass is my front left, drum has back right, and vocals has back left. So it's like everyone has their own speaker. So I'm getting blasted, but I'm getting every possible detail of that bass line and drum line and guitar lick and vocal style at like full volume. And I think that's maybe Feldy's style, is like, yeah, it's a live show. We want this record to be a live show.
That's a great point.
Maybe not, but that's kind of my, you know, take on that for now.
That's a great point. And it does in spots feel like a live show. Like we said, with maybe Memories at the beginning, the spots in the record that are slower on purpose to let you catch your breath, with Poetic Tragedy, with Blue and Yellow, with On My Own, those all kind of have their reasons for being where they are, I think, sequence-wise. And we're sequence nerds, we've said that before. I think Pieces Mended is a perfect album closer. This record fits two of our previous episode categories. The first track, the track one, side one, being a great song, and then last track, Magic, with Pieces Mended. It's just so spot-on perfect where it sits. And that's kind of how they would play a show, I would think. If you look at this, and I think around that time they were playing 8, 9, 10 of these songs, because we saw them. They played in Portland, Maine in April of 2003, and they played most of the record because that's what they had. And you got it kind of in that vein, where like Blue and Yellow is in the middle towards the end. And yeah, it was, man, just a hell of a fucking feel to this record. And it's Feldy and then the band, or the band and then Feldy, whatever way you want to do it. It was one big conglomeration of them figuring it out together.
And they did figure it out. One of my notes was, there's no skips on this thing. Like, this is, you know, most bands, when they have a label showcase at the Whiskey or whatever, you know what I mean? They get the execs from the labels. It's usually like a few songs. I look at this album as a giant showcase. This is us. Like, this is, there's no skips on it. It has something for everyone. And that's one thing that's one of the reasons why they got catapulted to the level they did, because you have a song like Box, which is massive and singy, screamy, and then you have Taste of Ink, which is sing-along. Like, that transcended everyone, you know, and everyone was a fan.
They buried myself a lot. They had hooks, man. They had hooks on top of being screamy and loud. They had hooks.
And that's a great segue to my next point, which is, if you look at bands of their ilk and category, the Thursdays of the world, the Thrices of the world, you could probably put Poison the Well in there. You know, these bands that came from maybe aggressive beginnings but signed to majors. The Used had like the perfect ingredients. They had tracks, a lot of fucking tracks. They had hooks. Not all those other bands had hooks. So right off the bat, they're ahead of some of those other bands. They have a front person, like a true front person that's not playing guitar. Thursday had one. Poison Well had one. Thrice did not. Thrice had Dustin, great front person, but not out there with just the microphone.
Yeah, playing guitar on top of it. Right, right.
Exactly. And then not only do you have a front person, you have one of the most charismatic, just an enigma of personality. Just this being that you can't even really make sense of it. Bert, he's like, he's got that, I don't know if we should cut this or not. He's got that Prozac smile. He's got the, you know, when we saw him in Portland for a signing in 2003, he looked hungover as hell. His hair was so greasy. He had sunglasses on inside. He is the epitome of a true front man. You throw in the production that's so slick. You throw in, have to fact check this, but I'm pretty sure he was dating Kelly Osbourne in that era.
Yeah, that sounds right.
He's dating this pop culture, I call her icon. So you've all
especially at that time with the Osbournes and the TV show. Yeah, yep.
So you have all these stars aligning that it all makes sense. And in the moment, you don't really realize that. But looking back, it's like, well, that's why I was drawn in. It wasn't just the music. It was the optics. It's a phenomenal band name. You got Bert, who's throwing up on stage. And,
yep.
You know, just, and you hear him in interviews, and he's just, sometimes he's there and sometimes he's not. And man, that's my observation looking back. It's like, it all makes sense.
Totally. Yeah. It all made sense in the moment. It all still makes sense today. I'm glad that they're still making, you know, a band and still doing it. They put a record out last year, I think, right? Last May. And that could have gone so many different directions that could have been poor for them as a band. And it didn't, which is amazing, especially with the kind of mercurial nature of Bert in this time period. I think he's certainly calmed down and become a little more of a family person. And they live in Australia, I think, now. And, he, you know, that you talk about that day with the sunglasses and the coffee. He looked at me and just said, "This coffee's fucking hot, man." And I think he had just rolled out of bed and into the fucking Bull Moose basement in Portland to sign a bunch of fucking CDs. And we still have them. I mean, you posted it the other day, Twan, on our Instagram, amongst other places. The signed CD booklet from 2003, April 2003. And the line for that fucking day, we were outside going into the building. It had to be, I don't know, two football fields long just to meet them for 2 seconds to get shit signed and walk out to go to the show later that day. And we were seniors in high school. We were getting ready to graduate. And that fucking show absolutely slayed. It's the first time I ever saw Rob in person, frequent guest on the podcast. He was behind me when Blue and Yellow started, and I heard him go, "Oh, nice." And I recognized his voice, and I was like, "It's fucking Rob," like local celebrity, radio hero of mine. There he is right there.
Yeah, that's such a good time capsule of the moment, because in stores were still happening. They still happen occasionally, but very rare. I feel like Amoeba Music and Fingerprint Records in Long Beach out here, like they have in stores once in a while, and it's like, it's almost like a rarity. Like, oh, dude, they're actually doing one. So that Bull Moose Music, I remember I brought the record, and I also brought a Kerrang magazine to get Bert to sign a live shot that was in the spread. But like you were saying, Twan, with like the whole like perfect ingredient thing, like there was a danger. I think had it not been for Bert, the danger that Bert brought to the music leveled up the music that much more. Like, okay, these lyrics, and then you meet him in person, and then you see him play live that night, you're like, oh, dude, this is Trent Reznor in 1999, you know, like fucking in pain, but writing about it too. And yeah, this is, you know, this is what fame looks like, but this is coming from a place that I don't even understand, but the music definitely transcends the live show 100%. So, what an era, like what a fucking era. The fact that we got to live this stuff as it was unfolding is still just kind of mind boggling. Cause I always felt like we missed out, not kind of being older in the 90s, but we really got something special with this scene and the Used and this record coming out at a fucking perfect time.
Well, and we saw him at the State Theater with Thrice and I think what, My Chemical Romance, before they were really like big. And think about that in a fucking 2000 cap venue right now. It's exactly. So wild.
And the story of the year too.
Yeah. Just nuts. Absolutely nuts. Those four bands are playing something that holds, they're playing football stadium right now if they're together on tour. right? I mean, they're playing something that holds 20,000-25,000 if they're playing indoor venues.
It's basically when we were young.
Yeah, pretty much. And we get to see that in a fucking 2,000 cap venue, man, because that's what we got back then. It was kind of a really cool moment for us because we weren't a market that necessarily got shows like that a super often. It didn't happen a ton. And the fact that it came through, they did a fucking in-store. We get to meet them. We get to go to the show. It was a nice spring day in Maine, which can be, you know, that time of year can be cold still. And everything, the stars kind of aligned for us. And we've been listening to the record for, you know, 9 months at that point and just saying, oh man, it'd be cool if they came. And then shit, here they are, sold out, 2,000 cap. Let's get down on the floor. Let's mix it up. Let's have some fun. We were so fucking lucky. And that doesn't happen all the time with bands like that, especially when you're, you know, 18, getting ready to graduate high school. You may not get to see a band that you are still talking about 20 years later, 21 years later. It's cool.
One thing we haven't really chatted about is the lyrics. I think you kind of alluded to it, Nate, that, you know, Burt was, you know, interesting history leading up to the band and a lot of life experience. Well, I think it definitely comes through in the lyrics, and there's so many one-liners in this. And that's another reason, you know, fans of music, it's all about making a connection. I mean, their name is awesome. The music's awesome. Burt is so likable. And then the lyrics, you know, you got, yeah, so many like one-liners that just resonate with people. Like, on my own, it's clear in my head, I'm screaming for something. Knowing nothing is better than knowing at all. Like, in so that good. Era, when you're 17, 18, like, that's your away message. Or on
what's an away message?
AOL Instant Messenger. Oh, for baby. All you millennials out there.
That was like, yeah, that was Twitter back in the day.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And then I think I had this as my away message. In bulimic, I'm about to see a million things I thought I'd never seen before. And I'm about to do all the things I've dreamed of. And I don't even miss you at all. Yep. I mean, who doesn't love those
goodbye
lyrics?
Goodbye to you. Goodbye yeah. to you. Another big hook.
Oh, my God. Yep.
Man. Oh, and then blue and yellow. Well, you're never going to find it. If you're looking for it, it won't come your way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could just read all the lyrics. And then, mm-hmm. like, Nate, you said box full of sharp objects, which is just, like, love and passion for music, which I don't know if you knew this, but the box of sharp objects is a measure of music.
Yeah. It's the notes it's in the box. It's the yeah. notes. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, who thinks of that shit? But
when
like,
I first saw that dude, I was like, oh my God, this is my band. Like, yeah. I need this in my life for all time because that's what I wanted to be a part of in some form or fashion to the point where we started this podcast. But it made me feel like I fit somewhere again with a music, with a band, with a group of people that liked similar things. That song kind of showed me that. And it's probably a top 20 song for me. And Blue and Yellow is probably a top 20 song for me all time. Like, those two songs, I can't get enough of. I could listen to on repeat.
I'm with you. Box full of sharp objects. Just the opening line, it's our time to shine. Like, it's we're here. Like, this is what we do. And do you want a song of glory? Well, I'm fucking screaming at you. I mean, to have that, to come up with that analogy, you have to be a unique mind. And I think we got one with Burt.
Yeah, all time front person.
Yeah, to your point on the box of sharp objects, I think I was talking about it kind of earlier in the episode. The meaning of that song, as soon as I understood what it meant, brought the band to a whole new level. Because it's like, okay, it's like he is really speaking to something that is the subject, but the cover of the whole subject, which is music and our appreciation for it. And the delivery of emotion through that vessel, which is music. So it really kind of brought it home for me with that song in particular. But I didn't know, like, you wouldn't know unless you really geeked out on it. Like you said, like, it just seems like, you know, a lot of people think it's a drug reference, like heroin or something.
No, it's a beautiful metaphor, which I had that conversation with my wife today. I said, do you know what a box of sharp objects is? And she was like, you're going to tell me, right? And I was like, yeah, I will. Because we were listening to the record and hanging out, and I'm like, yep, this is one of those things. When I realized what it was, I was that light bulb went off. I'm like, yes, this is fucking it. And she's like, that's really cool, actually. Yeah, I like that. Even though I'm not a huge fan of screaming, I like that.
It's that connection. Yeah, it's that. And they, especially with this album, and I mean, we're not here tonight to give the, you know, deep dive in the full catalog, but In Love and Death, the album they followed up, was primo. Like, that is almost so good. As good as this album. And I think there's a camp out there that thinks it's better, and they might not be wrong. Like, that album is so fucking good too.
So fucking good. Yeah, they kind of leaned into the fact that they were on a major but still were them. Like, we could totally do that, because that record, a lot of times the second record for a band like them does not hit, and this one absolutely did.
Yeah, I think that's a time of the week type thing. Like, which one's my favorite? I flip back and forth quite a bit. And I wonder sometimes if the second record was B-sides from this record, but I actually don't think so. I think they wrote those fresh, like, okay, we're on one, let's go.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I know that just in looking at the demos from the basement, most of the first album, this album, the Used album, was written in, what, 2000, 2001?
It is wild that it happened as quickly as it did, because they bring Bird in and then they're like, all right, let's bang out these fucking 7 or 8 classics and send them off to somebody to make it happen. And in 2002, they're putting it out. And then fall of 2002, they're taking over the world. And everybody and their brother's trying to sound like them and can't pull it off.
It's crazy. Yeah. And they still have a cheat code with Bert there. And I saw him this summer. Well, I guess technically last summer.
I'm so fucking jealous of that show. I should have gone. I really wanted to go. You talked to me. You're going to go to it? I'm going to it. I'm like, fuck, man, I should. And I just couldn't pull it off.
I think it was a day of. I decided to go. Tickets were super cheap. I think after fees, it was like $20. I was like, I got to go. But they played 12 songs. And 7 of the 12 songs were from these first two out, from The Used and In Love and Death. So they recognize that a lot of fans, like, that's when they brought in the bulk of their fans. You know, they definitely love that era. I'm definitely one of them. There's a few albums I never even heard, but like, I think the first 3 or 4 I really got into. And then this last one I really enjoyed.
Was that Toxic Positivity? Is that the one that came out last spring? Yeah.
And there's been some band member turnover, but oftentimes the sound changes so dramatically. I don't think it necessarily has with them. I think with Jeff and Bert are the two mainstays. They've kind of kept the essence of the band.
I can see that. I know they're good friends of the guys in Glassjaw, right? So Daryl and Beck are basically the last remaining OG members of Glassjaw. And like, I saw them a few weeks ago and the show was incredible. So with The Used, was the show still just like it was 2002? The
show was great. I mean, it was a huge room. So it was like, and that's what's so crazy is, Tone, when we saw them in 2003 and Nate in 2003, it's at a 1,500 or 1,800 cap room. This one was in a 8,000 cross insurance arena. I don't know if it was full, maybe 6,000, 5,000 or 6,000. Different show just by nature of the venue, but they still brought it. You know, check our socials from months ago. I posted a video. Energy was there, stage show was there, lights were there.
It's a cool video that you put together for socials too. If you haven't seen it, we don't just come to these decisions on bands and records to do lightly. It's stuff that we've lived and wanted to go check out and make fun little videos for social media for, because we fucking love this shit.
Yeah, I'm with you. We do fucking love it. We're still talking. So here's the thing, guys. I thought this album came out in 2000. When we decided to do this, I in my head thought this album came out in 2003. And then I started digging in. It was like 2002. Holy shit. Like, I can't even keep track of time anymore.
Happens, man. The life moves fast, comes at you fast, goes by fast. All those things. All those fucking, what's it called? You know what I mean? That shit just happens, man.
And we're getting older, but I think the confusion probably comes from because this sound took off in 03.
You literally took the words out of my mouth. It was because like this like defied time.
It
predicted. This is like the guy that says this is gonna be.
Is that idiot on TikTok that's like, be ready, this is happening 4 months from now. Like, he's making shit up, and if one of those things happened, he'd be like, I did it. I predicted the future. These guys were predicting the future 6 months before it happened. Yeah.
Buy Bitcoin. Okay, buddy. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. And now you're broke.
A broken clock is right twice a day.
Exactly. Yep. But shit. All right. The Used, self-titled record. One for the books. Kind of surprised we haven't done it to this point. And digging through all of the things that made me like it, love it. I'm happy that it was back on my radar to this level again. Because it was something that did not leave did not leave the CD player in the car for a very, very long time.
Yeah, it holds up tremendously. In fact, I might enjoy it now more than I even did back then. It just, it's crazy. And like, if you're listening to this and we've gotten this feedback, it's like, well, why didn't you talk about this song or this lyric, whatever? It's only an hour long. You know, that's, we could do another episode on this. And if there's something key that you thought we missed, let us know, hit us up. You know, maybe we can react to it in another episode, you know, certain production or certain lyrics or a deep cut song that we never talked about. But for me, I'll say this, front to back album, no skips, no misses, even the hidden song with
Bert. Choke just, Me is the name of it. Yeah.
Bert just going crazy.
Yeah, that song is fucking wild. And kind of there's also like that precursor to it where there's like a stripper or something singing happy birthday to him or something.
Oh yeah.
That's the age of the hidden song, 1999 to like 2003. Just crazy times.
Yeah, agreed. All around full front to back record. And I got to say, after prepping for this episode, I got to put this in the category of music therapy. This record is a fucking music therapy record, especially at full volume in the car in particular. Just takes away a lot of stress. And it's a lot to do with the production, but just the full, well-rounded element of this band from vocals to instrumentals is 10 out of 10. So I agree with you. Front to back record, fucking incredible. So stoked we got to talk about it tonight.
Hell yeah. And that would be a mic drop. I'm not dropping my mic like we did a couple weeks ago in Rob's basement because that's how you break the expensive shit that gets us to record these every week. But hey, thanks for checking out Audio Slave. Thanks for being there even once if this is the first time. And if you like it, go back, you know, hit up a couple old episodes. There's plenty of cool shit back there. I mean, this is after our 200th episode. So yeah, we get plenty back there for you.
We'll see you next week and the week after. And probably the week after that.
I hope so. Yeah.
See ya.
Nerd's gonna keep nerding.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Peace, potheads. Thank you for listening to Audio Slave. We are at Audio Slave on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all of the places that you can find us on social media. Facebook, Audio Slave Podcast. YouTube, Audio Slave Podcast there. Email us at audioslavepodcast@gmail.com. And hey, if you want to become a supporter, click on the link at the bottom of the episode and give us $1, give us $5. It keeps the lights on, keeps us going. We really appreciate that stuff. Thank you.